Okay, we're going to get started with Disney. It's a pleasure to welcome back Jay Rasulo, CFO of Walt Disney Company. So here's Jay. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi, everybody.
Very excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
So Disney's enjoyed substantial growth during your three-year tenure as CFO. Theme parks have benefited from expansion projects like Cars Land, tons of projects, that's just one. The media networks are nearly all the way through the all-important affiliate renewal cycle. The studios achieved new levels of success, well, put Lone Ranger aside, but you've had films like The Avengers. Consumer products is really, you know, it's totally rejuvenated. And interactive has found more healthy footing as well. Yet you seem to be consistently replenishing your growth pipeline. Between now and fiscal 16, which new growth drivers are you most optimistic about, and what are the key operating priorities for Disney to deliver on to make sure some of these investments are paying off?
Well, look, I think in the next few years, 16, and beyond, I think you'll see the Walt Disney Company following what has been a very, very successful strategy for us. We've made a lot of great investments, both through acquisition and organically, in content, branded content, its distribution through technology, its enhancement through technology, its distribution geographically, is really what we'll be executing against in the next few years. So if you look at what some of those big projects would be, we're obviously very, very excited about the 2015 release of Star Wars 7,
right.
The opening of Shanghai Disneyland, continuing to exploit and take advantage of both the Marvel successes with Avengers. We've got two more Marvel films coming out pretty soon with Thor and Captain America, and then, of course, eventually Avengers 2, taking advantage of those franchises along with Star Wars in our consumer products business. On the Disney Channel, we continue to invest in great programming. I mean, it's really a golden era for content at the Disney Channel, and the ratings have really shown that as we continue to, you know, climb the mountain in terms of ratings there. And so it really is, in the next few years, about great execution behind the fundamental strategy of developing and buying a great IP.
We estimate, I'm just going to maybe move to the balance sheet for a second. We're estimating a 15% compounded growth rate in free cash flow from the end of fiscal 12 through fiscal 15. Even if we assume $5 billion in capital returns during this period, $5 billion per annum, we estimate that you'll have a significant cash position of over $9 billion. So how should we think about potential uses of cash? Is Disney strategically complete?
Well, not coming on the details of your numbers, I think that based on the investment we have been doing, we will see an increase in cash flow. We've also worked our way through a huge capital cycle. But, you know, fundamentally, first and foremost, we want to continue to invest in our businesses, either through the organic implementation of growth initiatives, as I just mentioned, weighing into the great franchises we have, or to continue to grow our company through acquisition. We've been pretty consistent in how we have deployed capital. If you look at periods of time, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, we've deployed our capital, in a set of numbers I've talked about endlessly with you guys, which is about 60% of the capital that we have goes into our organic investment. About 20% has been spent in acquisition, and we've returned about 20% through buybacks and dividends. I will say that, looking into the near future, fiscal 14, that, given our confidence in what you've just said, the ability of these investments to return, and they are beginning to return, and our confidence in the overall company and where our share price sits in the marketplace, that we intend to significantly increase our buyback next year, probably in the $6 to $8 billion range. We've been buying at the pace of about $4 billion for the last couple of years. And we really see the opportunity, given where our share price is, given where capital markets are, to target at least six and possibly up to $8 billion in buyback. I want to emphasize that we won't do this and don't need to do this by bringing our debt rating down. We're very, very conscious of the strategic value of our single A rating. We think we can accomplish that buyback while maintaining that single A rating, even though we'll be probably doing some borrowing at the tail end to provide the capital for that plan. But I think that if the market conditions continue where they are and things turn out as we think they will, that's our plan and target for next year.
That's great. That's really great news. So happy to hear that. I guess one more question on that. I guess everybody's happy to hear that. Just on balance sheet, one other thing. I mean, I think accelerated capital returns is obviously a very, very positive. And you've been, in the last 5 years or so, you've really been the most aggressive of the media companies in terms of acquisitions. Everybody kind of pulled in after the recession. And it's helped the company and will actually drive growth for a long time. But when we think about, future acquisitions, and in the last couple have actually been surprising, are there any parts of your business you think could be improved through acquisition?
Well, our fundamental acquisition strategy has been across two prongs. Either the acquisition of IP that fits in our wheelhouse, in our expertise that we think we can exploit beyond where it's been exploited, and I would say that would describe both the Marvel acquisition and the Lucasfilm acquisition, but also, we've been demonstrative about saying that we're also interested in acquisitions that can increase our distribution capabilities, increase sort of the ecosystem under which we exploit the great and monetize all the great franchises that the company develops. So I wouldn't look for acquisitions from Disney that fall outside that basic strategic principle. I would say at this point in time, we don't feel like there are holes that we're out there trying to fill, either in the ecosystem or in the stable of IP that we have and continue to develop. But I think we've demonstrated that we remain extremely opportunistic about things that might show up that demonstrate to us that, yeah, this is a way for us to accelerate ourselves into a certain marketplace where our consumers live, where we think they're going to live in the future, or provide us geographies that we might. So, on the flip side, if you look at our investment in UTV, if you look at our investment in Playdom, those were acquisitions to really continue to fill in our ecosystem. But I don't think we're in a position today where we feel there's a necessity to go out and buy something. But if you look at the history of the company, acquisition has definitely been one of the vehicles by which we've grown the company.
Moving to kind of like your basic business, you derive a large chunk of profit from the U.S. pay TV ecosystem. And that's probably the part of the media sector that has the most uncertainty right now, given, changing consumption habits and potentially new players, over-the-top players. ESPN is reportedly talked to some of these OTT players. What is your view of the likelihood that the launch and the success? I guess the success, it's hard to say since it hasn't launched, but, what can you tell us about whether it's Sony, Google, or Intel, how we should think about it? Should we think about higher sub fees? Will it be a Me Too product? Is there anything different?
Well, look, let me start by saying that we are extremely happy in our position with the channels that we have and the way they are performing, whether it's ESPN and our sports franchise, the far and away number one position it holds, whether it's the Disney Channel and its two flanker channels that are doing so amazingly well, ABC Family that continues to grow every year, or the ABC Network. We are very, very happy with what we bring to the table in terms of content. And make no mistake about it, our emphasis is to be a player in that marketplace with great content, because we believe that with strong content, however the pay TV business evolves,
from sort of the traditional MVPD ecosystem to over the top providers of various sorts, maybe someday a full over the top MVPD supplier, that when you step to the table with great content, you're really in the driver's seat. We have been, as a company, probably the most aggressive content creator in terms of embracing technology. If you look way back when we stepped out on iTunes and people told us, wow, you're going to kill the value of your television product. Well, of course, all those things have been proven to be the exact opposite. And when we sit down, even with traditional players in that space, we push mobile, we push other services, what we think are consumer-facing services, and try to be where consumers want to be and will be tomorrow. So I think that we're very happy to have more players, whether it's the ones you mentioned or Amazon or Netflix or whoever else steps up. And we're engaged in conversations with everyone. We've done many, many deals, and I think we've done a really good job at managing the balance between the traditional MVP ecosystem, which has been very good to us, and we are very good to it in terms of the content we provide, but at the same time taking advantage as these new forms of distribution pop up to both be consumer sensitive in meeting their desire to see Disney content on those vehicles, as well as monetizing the content that we create more fully.
Can you give us an update on what you're seeing in terms of advertising trends, both at the national level and local as well?
Yeah, the advertising trends have not changed that much since our last quarterly update in August. We're seeing basically the same trends that have been out there. The market's pretty good. Judging from the upfront, we're very happy with both the pricing and the volume that both ABC Network as well as ESPN was able to sell in the upfront, and we feel pretty good about it. No change in trend.
Okay. And then retrans is obviously an important growth driver for your business. It's become obviously very public, contentious fights most recently with Time Warner Cable and CBS. But it does seem that there's a big step up, given that the last round with CBS. You guys have articulated a target of $400 to $500 million by 2015. Some of your peers have said $1 billion by 2017. Obviously, they're just different size station groups, but you all get reverse comp. What makes your opportunity different than anyone else's? Is it the O&O size?
Jessica, it's very hard to prepare what companies say about their forecast for retrans, because as you said, it's a different footprint. We're always talking about different time periods. CBS is now into their sort of second phase of retrans, and the numbers and targets they're talking about probably have to do with years beyond where we've given the target. So it really is very hard. I feel pretty confident that with the strength of our stations, we're number one in 7 out of the 8 markets where our local TV stations are, and we feel pretty good about the reverse comp that we're getting for those stations. So I wouldn't read too much into the nominal numbers that are given out, because they're very hard to compare company to company.
Okay, but there's logically no difference unless there's some allocation. It just doesn't really make that much sense. But anyway, moving on, ESPN. Is obviously your roster of sports programming has been unparalleled. Your success in monetizing that is also unparalleled. Your number of brands that you've created, it's just unparalleled. So is there something you need to do, given the rising competition? You're obviously by far the dominant player. I'm not even saying anything else. But do you see any impact from this upcoming, from this newer competition, both Fox and NBC, and what do you need to do to kind of ensure your dominance?
Yeah, well, look, I think that the game plan we've followed at ESPN, we've had the ability, because of our position in the business, so far and away the number one brand in sports, that we've really been able to follow our own compass. And our own compass has been to acquire the sports rights in their fullest monetization scheme both, you know, sort of in the traditional linear as well as digital and mobile, and lock them in for a long time. And the result of that has been a portfolio of sports
that we have today, sports rights,
that is really unequaled in the business and puts us in a very, very strong position. So not do I feel like our position is great today, but I see it as many of these deals have been, give us sports rights up, you know, 8, 10, 15 years out as really having a great lock. I mean, when we look at, you know, the size and the, okay, let me stop for a second, otherwise only you and I.
Right.
Okay. Is that good?
Do you hear that now?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look at, for instance, just in terms of size and scale and, you know, how far and difficult it is to build a brand, since Fox Sports 1 launched on August 18th, the increase in viewership on ESPN year over year is about equal to the total viewership that Fox Sports has had since they launched. Just the increase, the delta from prior year.
Right.
So that's not to say they don't have a great, they're not launching a good network and they, you know, are not doing a good job. It just is an indication of the scale and how far along the curve we are in our business relative to those who are entering the business. So we feel pretty good about it. We're not complacent. We're not sitting back on our laurels. We don't have our head in the sand. We are aggressively out there continuing along the strategy that has made ESPN so successful. Buy great rights, constantly look for new ways to get sports programming in front of viewers on the best available screen that they have to them at the time they want to view, and thirdly, continue to use technology and push ourselves to do great production.
You've locked in long-term sports rights. How should we think about the durability of ESPN's operating margins over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, you know, we've been saying for some time, and I think quarter after quarter and year after year demonstrated, we still see ESPN as a growth business. We don't manage the business on a quarter-to-quarter margin basis. We really manage it along the terms that I mentioned to you. You know, there are not that many variables in the business. There's, you know, the affiliate fees, which, you know, 7 out of our 10 big affiliate deals are done. The next couple will be done soon. They're long-term. The fundamentals of our cost base are pretty well locked in the long-term sports rights we have. Advertising continues to be strong because up through today, 96% of people, 96% of sports are viewed live, and that makes it very appealing for advertisers. So we continue to try to offer something that excites sports fans every day in terms of following their passion.
Maybe moving on to the parks, I want to make sure we cover all your businesses. Your domestic attendance in the fiscal third quarter was up 3%. Which was substantially better than the pure play theme park operators, and actually pretty notable given that you had the unfavorable Easter shift. There was some tough weather in Orlando, and you had price increases as well. What were the biggest drivers of your outperformance?
Well, I think you can view our outperformance really as the result of a very strong investment strategy that we embarked on about 5 years ago. And, you know, that is, of course, the investment first and foremost at the Disneyland Resort behind Cars Land. That has hit every note we hoped it to hit, both in terms of the increase in attendance at the Disneyland Resort, our ability to price behind those investments, as well as a radical change in the distribution of visitors between Disney's California Adventure and the traditional Disneyland. So it's been a home run, has been really the driver on the West Coast. On the East Coast, we're just about wrapping up a big investment program there in Fantasyland. The Magic Kingdom is the most visited theme park in the world. Fantasyland is the most popular part of the most visited theme park in the world. And reinvesting in it, reinvigorating it, giving guests the services they want to experience has been the fundamentals beyond the driver there. Weather was not a big effect on us last quarter. And, you know, we had a record third quarter at the Disneyland Resort, a record third quarter at Walt Disney World in terms of attendance. So it is just great management of the business, continuing continuing to give guests what they want, being eager and proud to invest in high return projects that are, you know, incremental, that create both incremental pricing and incremental attendance.
Right. And you mentioned on the last call that international visitors, I think, you just really kicked up a lot. It seems like they've really come back to...
Yeah, the international visitation has picked up. It was up 7% year-on-year. The drivers there on the East Coast, you know, not shocking, Brazil has been the biggest driver there. The U.K. was also a driver last quarter. And on the West Coast, the influx has been from Mexico, Australia to some extent, Canada, but yeah, we're very happy with the appeal and the breakthrough that we've gotten with these large investments in international markets.
What's the range of international visitors?
The range of international visitors on the East Coast is like usually between 17% of total. Up, it's been as high as 23 or 24% of total, but you know. With the investments that we've talked about, we've also grown our domestic base a lot, so I'm not sure that's a very important measure. And on the West Coast, it's less than that. I think it's more in the around the 10% range.
I think the only reason it might be important is don't international visitors stay longer?
They tend to stay longer. More importantly, they spend more.
Spend more.
Because, you know, it's fundamental economics. The costs, the fixed costs in them arriving at the front gate are so substantial that... spending more when they're there is a much smaller percentage of their budget versus, you know, a family that wakes up in Southern California and drives to Disneyland. It's a very different economic decision. But they have been a great contributor to the profitability on that business. And they do, in Orlando in particular, they do tend to stay like 2 weeks in market as opposed to the typical 8 days that domestic visitors stay. But, you know, been a fundamental building block in our growth and success in the business.
You've been making significant investments in technology and the guest experience with My Magic Plus. It's rolling out, I think, in the first fiscal quarter of 2014. Can you discuss the ins and outs of the initiative? You know, what should we expect from an ROI perspective? And you've alluded to revenue opportunities.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe if you could give us some color on that. And also, the cost, you know, was like a kind of a, the cost was coming through. When does that start to come down?
Okay. So My Magic Plus, for those of you who don't know, is a very sophisticated system that, you know, is pre-visit, during visit, and post-visit use of technology to basically enhance the guest experience at Walt Disney World. I would say there are two fundamentals about the revenue opportunity behind it. The first and most important is that we've known for many years the further in advance guests plan their vacation to Walt Disney World, the more time they spend with us. So, you know, a decade ago, 20 years ago, we used to talk about ticket sales at Origin, trying to get people to buy tickets as part of a package. This is, you know, fast forward 20 years, this is, you know, full resort visit planning online, very sophisticated tools, including, you know, booking your fast passes, booking your restaurants, booking everything that you wish to book in advance about your stay at home, receiving all of that booking data on an RFID-based wristband that you wear while you're in the park that becomes your hotel room key, your wallet, your, you know, admission tickets to the park, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and also allows us to if you wish and you opt in, to know where you are when. So the fundamental driver that we feel is, number one, like every other enhancement of our product, the better the product gets, the more people want to come and visit, whether that's new attractions, new services, or in this case, the combination of planning tools and on-site conveniences that this technology will provide. That in terms of its ability to drive volume and spending, because people who plan in advance tend to spend more at Walt Disney World, are the key drivers of the revenue push behind that. However, A secondary driver of revenue will be the services that we can now offer on a personalized basis, because we know who you are, where you are, and if you tell us why you're coming to Walt Disney World for this vacation, whether you're a first-time visitor, a 50th-time visitor, it's your child's fifth birthday, it's a graduation, it's an anniversary, the more you share with us as a guest, the more we're able to tailor services, and we think, you know, get lift in selling those services. So that's the fundamental economics. The investment in the project is nearly behind us because, in fact, we are in an end-to-end beta test right now of the system. We continue to increase. About 125,000 guests have experienced this with very, very positive results in terms of their experience. And, you know, we're walking before we run so that when you come down and use the service, you're going to feel really good about how it works and not experience glitches, which is our business and not the guest's business. So we're cautiously rolling it out, but, you know, by the end of the first quarter of fiscal 14, we will have substantial coverage of our resort guests and ultimately all guests who visit the property under this technology. We have felt from the very start that this is a project with very attractive returns, double-digit returns for us. And, you know, we have seen, whether it was My Magic Plus, which was, at the time, an innovative pricing and ticketing plan, whether it was Disney Express, which, you know, brings people from the airport and so on and so forth, every one of these projects plays great dividends for us down there. We're very optimistic about this one, too.
Okay. And moving on to something you guys are even more optimistic about, Shanghai. It's well underway, and the plan is to open late 2015. Can you talk about some of the challenges and, you know, in terms of opening it up in time, meeting local demand,
Sure. The timeline, you know, obviously when you're taking on a huge construction project, which this is, you're always concerned about the complexity of the project, the new market where we haven't done a big construction project. But so far I'm happy to say that it has been smooth sailing. Whatever speed bumps along the way we've hit, we've overcome with our partners, the Shanghai government. So we are very much along the track of opening at end of calendar 2015 as we had planned. And I, you know, as of right now, we don't see any obstacles to making that date. In terms of demand, obviously the challenge is there. When you go to a new market, you can never really know, how guests are going to respond to your creative. But from our perspective, from the Disney side, we are pushing it out there to the limit of new, using new technologies, really introducing products that have not been seen before, and really looking at the Magic Kingdom in 2015 as opposed to the Magic Kingdom in 1955. We've really kind of stepped all the way back and said, hey, if you kind of a zero-based budgeting, if this was the first time you were doing this, how would you design it as opposed to what's done in the past? It will be clearly recognizable as a Magic Kingdom by you, by anybody who's ever been to one of our Magic Kingdoms, but I think it really speaks to, 21st century guests and their desires. The blend, and the sophisticated blend between, the Disney content and the Chinese local adaptation of that and Chinese local content is something that we've put an enormous amount of attention to. We always think, and I think we've always been right, that when we bring our product to markets, even new markets, guests fundamentally want Disney. But they also want a recognition of who they are, what their traditions are, what their culture is, and how they can have the most fun when they're there. So we put a lot of attention to that. The capacity that we're building means someday Shanghai Disneyland has the landmass probably to be our second largest destination around the world, anywhere in the world. And that is, our second largest destination today is the Tokyo Disney Resort, which does about 28 million guests a year. So we think it can surpass that someday, and certainly with the capacities there. On opening day, We are providing, we think, enough capacity not to be capacity constrained as we were a little bit in Hong Kong, where, you know, we thought we built to the market there, but clearly smaller than we had built in the past. We've subsequently added a lot of attractions, and they've been very quickly absorbed in terms of the attendance in Hong Kong Disneyland. By the way, Hong Kong Disneyland's really on fire, and it is a great sign leading up to our Shanghai opening. But I think we're going to be fine in terms of capacity for opening day. And at the same token, both we and our partners are ready for a rapid expansion if the market turns the way we expect it to in Shanghai.
All right. And increasingly we hear about theme park development in and around mainland China. What's your assessment of the competitive landscape?
Look, I think, we've never worried anywhere in the world about, you know, theme park alternatives and what other people do. We do what we do. We're very successful at it. We're good at it. And we feel good about, how we conduct our business. However, I think it's a very good indication of where the Chinese middle class is. They're at the point in middle class development where they are really demanding entertainment. And I'm thrilled, and we're thrilled as a company, that the form of entertainment they're demanding and that the market is responding to is this form of outdoor recreation. So we see it as a very, very good sign that there's an inherent interest in this. People go, families go, and have a great time, and we think that it really is a very auspicious trend relative to our opening in 2015.
Okay, I'd love to talk about Shanghai. We'll be three more divisions, and I have to get the audience. So on the film side, you have an incredible outlook in fiscal 15 and 16. Avengers 2, Finding Dory, the sequel to Finding Nemo. I think Pirates 5, you just moved back a little bit, but obviously the big kahuna is Star Wars, the first one in the next trilogy. How do you feel about the slate between now and then?
You know, we feel very, very good about the direction that our studio slate is headed. Some of that has been through being smart on the acquisition front and really allowing ourselves to do big budget tentpole movies with the confidence behind them, like Star Wars, like Marvel films, like Disney Animation, like Pixar Animation, which, by the way, makes up the vast majority of our slate, those films behind those four franchises. And we feel, that we have found our stride in basically a slate that looks like, two Marvel films a year, one Star Wars, either trilogy film or origin story film, one Disney animation, one or two Pixar animations. We really feel that combined with one or two, maybe three, if the creative juices allow it, Disney live action tentpole movies, and then some other films that will be Disney live action branded but not be of a tentpole nature. I think we've also learned, and you mentioned Lone Ranger. I think we've also learned that there needs to be a cap on tentpole non-franchise movies. We need to cap those at a level that allows us to experience good economics and doesn't quite put as much at risk. So going forward, you're really going to see a cap on the spending on those movies, which I think from a risk management perspective puts us in a much better place in terms of our studio slate. Now, in the coming year this year, we have Maleficent. We have Frozen from Disney Animation, which is coming out, which I can tell you I've seen multiple cuts of this film. It is going to be absolutely fantastic. We have The Good Dinosaur coming out from Pixar, which we're very excited about. And we've got, the sequel to our first origin film on Thor, which is in great shape. We screened it last week. Extremely exciting and fun, and continues to grow that franchise. same thing along with Captain America and the Winter Soldier, which will be the follow-up to the original Captain America, leading again into Avengers 2. So we feel really good about what's going on the Marvel film franchises. And, of course, we're putting enormous effort in the company, by the way, not only at the studio, but every part of the company behind Star Wars 7, which we cannot be more excited
and,
about.
And on to, I have the Star Wars. I mean, it's been 10 years since the last live-action movie was released. How do you market this to, like, the younger audiences? What are the challenges that you have?
Well, I don't think we see any particular challenges to marketing Star Wars to a broad audience, young audience and families and everyone alike. Remember that this is a franchise that has been evergreen for 35 years. Even in long gaps of film production, it has been a leading licensing product. It's always in the top few franchises in terms of licensing revenue for franchises around the world. So clearly, that licensing is mostly, particularly for Star Wars, has been mostly around in the toy category and mostly to kids. So this is not a new franchise to kids, even if they haven't seen the film, whether they've experienced it through Lego, whether they've experienced it through other, versions and forms. When we introduced our Jedi training at our parks, kids were lined up for a mile to train as a Jedi. Now, where did they learn what Jedis do and who they are and why and who Darth Vader is? I don't know. Maybe like Disney, they learned it from their parents. But the point is, the market is extremely hot for everything Star Wars. So of all our worries, that's not one of them.
You mentioned two things. So just to follow up quickly. On the consumer products, when you bought Lucasfilm, consumer product revenue was only like $215 million.
Right.
So can you give us an update on, but you said it's been a consistently huge, licensed product. So where do you stand in terms of reinvigorating that whole consumer products effort?
Well, the strategy behind the Star Wars consumer products, number one, is put out a great film, right? That's number one. But other than that, as I mentioned, Star Wars has been very narrowly focused in the licensing world around toys and books, a few other categories. If you look at Marvel and Disney, we are both much broader in terms of other categories, soft goods, houseware, and all the stuff you see us in, and now you see Marvel in. They've also been somewhat U.S.-centric relative to Marvel and Disney. So our strategy was always both broaden the license offering as well as broadening and deepening the geography in which Star Wars will be offered. Like a lot of smaller companies, like Marvel, when we bought them, they don't have the bandwidth to have their own arms and legs around the world promoting their products, their licensed goods, doing deals. They used a lot of reps and agents. Our strategy with Marvel and, again, with Star Wars is to take that all in-house into what is the biggest and most powerful licensing organization in the world. And so up until 2015, we will lay the groundwork for all of that, just as we did with Marvel in anticipation of the Avengers. And then when the film comes out in 2015, we'll be ready to blow it out.
And on the theme park side, how much flexibility do you have to exploit the IP in the park? Could there be a Star Wars land?
I think the sky's the limit. There is incredible flexibility. In the late 80s, George Lucas and Disney teamed up to introduce Star Wars into Disney parks. There's a Star Tours ride in every Disney location, and it was so natural for consumers. They got it right from the get-go. It's been incredibly popular. Most of them have been updated. Some will be updated. We did the Jedi Academy. So we know this is a good fit for our theme parks, and it is an unbelievable palette for us to create from.
I need another hour with you, but I only have time for one question before we open it up for the audience.
Okay.
And at least touch on interactive. You released Infinity on August 18th. Can you give us, it's such a different product for you. Can you give us an update on, early reaction, early consumer response to that product?
We are extremely happy with the early days of Infinity. Make no mistake about it, it's early days. We launched in August. Of course, at launch, we thought there would be, a huge interest. There was. We're now, seasonality-wise, in a slow period, beginning of school, not the best. But, of course, anticipating very big things into the holiday selling period, you know, starting November up until the end of year holidays. I don't want to be too definitive about something that's in early days, but if you think about a really great product that has come out recently that is, you know, has some similarities to Infinity, which is the Skylanders, you know, and Skylanders Giants in particular, the second round. You know, our sales have been on par with that, even though we launched in August, and usually they do theirs, you know, September, October. The sales have been actually, you know, on that level, a little better. So it's an early indication people being interested. We've got some great early feedback about the age demographic using the game. You know, it's a little older than we anticipated. Average is like 13. We've got, you know, a certain percentage of users over 20. The most interested platforms are what they call next-gen platforms, which is, you know, not DS, not Wii, but deeper platforms, Xbox and PlayStation, which is very good for, means that core gamers are really interested in this and are interested in the depth of the content. You know, our sales have over-indexed at places like GameStop, where core gamers go, as opposed to, you know, other broad retailers. So all indications are great, but very early days. But we're excited about it.
Let's open it up.
Sure.
Okay. And I knew there'd be a question.
Thank you. Jay, one result of your business that I find perplexing is the rate of growth recently in consumer products licensing. So from 2005 to 2008, that business grew consistently double-digit on a year-over-year basis. And since that period of time, you've reorganized, you've got the benefits of Marvel, you've had great film content. My anecdotal observations is that your product is actually expanding with consumers, yet the growth for the last, since 2011, has only been about low single-digit growth. Why that discrepancy or that moderation?
Well, look, I think that when you look at, you know, any time period for our consumer products business, you have to be very careful about the starting point and ending point, because there are franchises. We look at managing our consumer products business across a huge spectrum of episodic franchises that have, you know, sort of big bursts when there's entertainment product issued, and things that are are lower when there isn't, and evergreens, which, you know, are always high. But there are some franchises within what we do, like Cars, for instance, that are absolutely on fire when we put new product out into the market. We saw an indication of that when we introduced Planes, which is from the world of Cars, and saw how even Cars merchandise took off again in addition to Planes merchandise. So over long periods of time, we are very, very happy with the growth of that business. It's a wild contributor to the margins of the company. It's a wild contributor to the OI of the company. And we continue to fuel that engine, knowing that the timing of release of entertainment products, there's going to be ebbing and flowing among the portfolio. And as I said, you measure different time periods and you get very different growth rates. But I don't think there's anything secular that I'm worried about in terms of the growth trajectory of that business. I think you'll see some unbelievable years. I would guess in 2015, given what Jessica just said, Nemo was a gigantic merchandise franchise. Star Wars is coming out. You know, you'll come back and say, wow, can you sustain that 20x% growth in consumer products? So you've got to be a little bit careful about how you measure it.